Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up on the show this morning, we'll have more on continued allegations of abuse against migrant children being held in detention centers here in Arizona. And the Phoenix Art Museum looks to the future as its leader leaves and controversy swirls.
But first, state utility regulators will not undo the rate hike they approved for APS in 2017. Members of the Arizona Corporation Commission voted 4-1 yesterday against the request from customers led by Stacey Champion. The panel did, however, vote to adopt a new code of ethics. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services was at yesterday's lengthy meeting and is with us now. Hey, Howie.
Good to be here. I don't know how much that code of ethics helps the ratepayers who think they're getting you-know-whatted.
Yeah, it seems like they're maybe two slightly different issues. Let's start with the rate hike. And we heard at the very top of the hour from Stacey Champion, who was trying to, she's an APS customer and an activist, trying to get this rate hike undone. Sounds like she was pretty fired up yesterday.
Oh, definitely. I think that she said, look, the numbers are clear. APS said this was going to be a 4.54% average increase, about $6 a month. And that was based on some really wonderful, bizarre figures about, well, the increase is more, but we have some offsets. But the offsets didn't all take effect, at least not immediately. Plus the fact that, again, this is an average. And so you had some customers who were moved into new rate plans. And while the rates went down for some, they went up for a lot. I mean, by double what APS advertised. And she said, look, what you did back in 2017 clearly didn't fit what APS said they were selling you, so you need to reopen it. But the commissioner said, look, at this point, we might as well just continue, let them continue to charge the rates, and we'll revisit it with their next rate case in the next 12 to 18 months.
So does that mean then that those customers who are paying more will just continue paying more unless they drastically reduce their usage?
Well, that's really interesting, because what is clear is that APS, when they shifted customers into new rate plans, didn't necessarily shift them into the cheapest rate plans. I mean, there's all sorts of issues of time of day and demand charges and whether it's a full moon or a Tuesday and things that affect your bill. And so APS was supposed to spend about $5 million educating customers as to what is the cheapest rate plan. Well, in some cases, they clearly didn't do the job because customers just sort of maybe left things the way they were. And so what the order does require, though, is for APS to now go back, educate their customers, and give them another chance to change their rate plans. So for some people who just like getting the bill and paying it, they're still going to end up paying more. But for those who are willing to take the time, they may be able to chip away a few bucks a month on what they're paying.
All right, Howie, let's talk about the new code of ethics that the commission voted on yesterday. This has been a big issue, especially in light of some of the recent elections where APS has spent a lot of money to try to get commissioners and successfully get commissioners that they want on the panel, on the panel.
Well, definitely. This addresses specifically one issue of, can you take money directly from, let's say, APS, APS executives, APS employees, APS lobbyists, and I'm picking on APS because, as you point out, you know, they're the 800-pound gorilla in all of this. What this proposal by Commissioner Boyd Dunn says is, you can take the money. I mean, we can't keep you from accepting campaign contributions, but if you take the money, you cannot vote on any matter affecting that particular person. And so the idea is to be a disincentive for utilities to give, knowing that even if you, quote unquote, buy a commissioner, they won't do you any good because you won't be able to get their vote.
It seems like there's a lot of wiggle room there, though. I mean, like, if somebody at APS gives a commission candidate money, could one make the argument that a vote doesn't necessarily affect that employee's division or that part of APS?
Well, Commissioner Dunn, who is a former judge and a former attorney, said he thinks he's kind of covered this completely. It covers the employees, it covers the executives, it covers the lobbyists, it covers the hired attorneys. And so you don't have to parse it out that badly. Now, are there ways around this? Certainly. What we saw back in 2014 is that APS gave money to other organizations, which then spent money outside on independent expenditures to elect certain candidates. Now, theoretically, that was not APS giving money to the candidates, but it clearly helped them elect who they want. I'm not sure that any of this can help that, because as being independent expenditures, it's not the candidate seeking the money. It's somebody else helping them out without their knowledge.
All right. Certainly lots more to come on these, both of these decisions from the Corporation Commission. That's Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, as always, thank you.
Well, you're very welcome.
It's been 8 months since Phoenix voters overwhelmingly approved a ban on so-called dark money in local campaigns. This week, Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego announced the ban will go into effect. It's been under legal review by the governor's office since it passed in November. Mayor Gallego hailed the move as momentous for the city that truly had bipartisan support.
Voters approved this proposition with 85% support. That is overwhelming numbers. That makes it about as popular as chocolate ice cream. So we're really excited to see that voters across party lines, across ages, agree we want open and transparent elections.
She says this is personal to her, and she hopes the effects of the ban will be felt in future city elections.
I'm really hopeful that it will be a more positive election, with people being more accurate if they have to put their name on it. There's a real need to be accountable to what you're saying. I was attacked with dark money from people who actually agreed with the stance they were attacking me for. I think voters need to know that and know it's pure politics and not really people who care about the issues. So I'm very optimistic that we'll have more positive, fact-based elections in the city of Phoenix.
So what took so long, and how have the politics surrounding dark money affected this? Corey Langhofer is a managing partner at legal firm Statecraft and focuses on election law. He also served as counsel for President Trump's campaign and transition team. I began by asking him about this 8-month-long legal review. What does that process look like?
So once a charter city adopts a charter or an amendment to the charter, it gives it significant latitude and in some cases, the ability to adopt laws that are different from the laws that would apply outside the charter city, the ordinarily applicable statewide laws. And for that reason, the Arizona Constitution gives the governor's office the ability to review and approve charters and charter amendments before their final take effect. So in this case, it appears the governor's office has taken quite a while to look this over. This is a pretty controversial amendment in the city of Phoenix, and it's not unprecedented. There's a similar amendment in the city of Tempe, but it's not one that has a lot of political support at the governor's office. I suspect they just ultimately concluded they didn't have a legal basis for not approving it and therefore signed off on it, although begrudgingly.
So give us a sense of how this squares with state law, because we saw this issue, like you mentioned, flare up when Tempe passed a similar ban.
So the state law in Arizona is reasonably protective of donor privacy. If you follow a certain set of rules, you can give money without being publicly identified in the state of Arizona, even if the people you give that money to are politically active. It's not easy. Like, there's a long set of rules that needs to be followed, but it can be done in Arizona, and it is done with some frequency. So that won't really be possible in the city of Phoenix as long as they enact an implementing ordinance. They do have a little bit of follow-up work to do with that ordinance, but once they do that, political activity in the city of Phoenix will likely be fully disclosed going forward.
So what does it mean then that there is sort of a patchwork of laws like this, like in certain cities like these two that have passed this ban, as opposed to a statewide law, which, by the way, we should mention there is a campaign by Terry Goddard and some others who are trying to raise money and signatures to get a statewide ban on dark money on the ballot again, but that at this point doesn't exist. How do you deal with the fact that these laws will apply differently in different places?
It makes it difficult for politically active organizations and politically interested individuals to know what their options are. You drive across town, Phoenix is a large area, you'll pass through 5 or 6 cities as you drive across town. You wouldn't know that the laws change every time you cross one of those lines. Mm-hmm. In most states, the laws don't have significant changes on the local level. There's a statewide campaign finance ordinance or statute that governs, and that's more or less it. Arizona's starting to not follow that trend on this issue of donor privacy.
And let's talk about why that is. What is the political debate around this? I mean, Phoenix voters approved this, but, others like the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce were really opposed to it.
Yeah, my own view is, I think the simplest explanation for why this is controversial and who opposes it doesn't do with a principled discussion about whether donor privacy is good or bad. I think it's easiest to predict where someone falls in this debate by looking at their other political beliefs. Are they Republican? Are they Democrat? After the 2010 and 2012 elections, it was almost entirely Democrats who opposed donor privacy, because Republicans were primarily using undisclosed contributions to impact elections. That has largely shifted, though. And so I think most of the energy on the political left has been lost on this issue. But you do have some holdouts, like you mentioned Terry Goddard. Mm-hmm. It's his third time around trying to change statewide law on this. I think that you just don't see a lot of people who are interested in it anymore, because now everyone's participating equally.
That's Corey Langhofer, managing partner at Statecraft. Corey, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure being on.
The Phoenix Art Museum is officially looking for a new leader. Yesterday was Amata Cruz's last day as director and CEO. She's going to Seattle to take a similar position with that city's art museum. The Phoenix Art Museum also recently let some staff go and announced it ended the most recent fiscal year with a roughly $2 million deficit. Joining me to talk about the art museum's future, both in terms of its finances and a new CEO, is Mark Feldman. He's the treasurer of the museum's board of trustees, as well as its incoming co-chair. And Mark, as you move to that co-chair position, do you have particular priorities you're looking to take on?
Yeah, there's a number of things that are the focus areas of our activities as we approach the summer and the fall. First off is we now have a vacancy in our CEO spot with Amata Cruz's departure to the Seattle area and running that museum. We will have to fill that position, number one. Number two, we will be focused on our financial stability and revenue development activities. That will be continue to be keys for us as we focus internally on things for the museum. And then as we think about externally, we continue to have a focus on accessibility to the art museum, as well as the educational programming that we offer.
You mentioned the departure of Amata Cruz. I'm wondering, how would you describe her tenure as head of the museum?
It was an environment featuring substantially increased accessibility to the museum, substantially increased connections with our community. In a short period of time, we have increased the number of visitors to the museum. We've increased the number of people at the lower end of the giving spectrum to donate to our art museum. So I think Amata's leadership can be characterized largely by a much more significant connection with the entirety of the community, as well as accessibility of the museum. And we are excited for those things to continue to have momentum.
Her tenure, though, also was marked by a bit of controversy, and I don't want to get into the specifics of any of it, but I'm wondering if, when you look at some of those aspects, how you think about those relative to whoever her successor will be.
Well, person carries their own strengths and weaknesses, and I've yet to find the perfect person in my life other than, of course, my wife. And so in that spirit, we will continue to look at the where we could be better at, where we could improve, where we could make better connections with some of our constituents, whether they be docents, volunteers, employees, or people that we interact with all around the community. And so we do recognize that the quality of those interactions is directly connected to our ability to be effective as a leader in the community in art education and art participation.
Well, given that, I'm wondering if you have a sense of some of the qualities that you'll be looking for in the next director.
We will look for someone who has experience running an art museum of this size, someone who is familiar with the aspects of fundraising in a town like Phoenix, Arizona, someone who interacts well with other colleagues in the community, and most importantly, someone who can continue the diversity, inclusiveness, and access that is an integral part of what our museum is all about today.
Do you think that that person might already be in Phoenix or Arizona? Do you expect to have to look outside the city or the state for that person?
We would would be delighted if the person came from Phoenix. We are not limiting our search geographically. Of course, it would always be wonderful if someone locally could be that person. It's possible. I wouldn't give it a high probability, but it's possible.
So a little earlier, you mentioned working on the financials for the museum, and the museum recently announced that it would be ending the current fiscal year with a deficit of around $2 million. What led to that deficit? Because it hadn't been the case and certainly hadn't been the word from the museum that it was having financial issues.
The art museum is not in financial difficulties. We had a difficult financial year that just ended last week. And the primary reasons for that were inconsistency with our development team in retaining them and having them be effective in the community. We just had gaps in our development team that didn't allow us to optimize and maximize some significant donations that we had received in years past. For the first 2 or 3 years of Amada's term, we had run surpluses and were able to eliminate some debt that had occurred prior to her beginning as the CEO. And so we had made great progress. And so this year was a hiccup for sure. And with the continued building and investing in our development team, we look forward to smoothing out the loss and ramping up towards break even or surpluses in order to solve this issue.
When you look at some of that smoothing, do you anticipate trying to advance the revenue side or trying to reduce the expenditure side? And the museum recently let a number of employees go. Are you looking at spending cuts? Are you looking to try to boost the revenue? What's the equation there?
Well, that is precisely the equation, Mark. We had to reduce some expenses, and we unfortunately had to let 7 full-time people and 1 part-time person go. That's always difficult. We have about 200 employees, and so our goal is to not make any additional cuts and, in fact, to make some investments, particularly around the programmatic and the development area. But our most important activity beyond expense reductions, which move the needle only slightly, is regaining the revenue momentum that we had with this new development team that we're putting in place.
When you look at the Phoenix Art Museum 3, 5, 7, 10 years down the road, what do you see?
Continued increase in accessibility. I see financial stability with the hiring of this new CEO, as well as leadership by the board and the quality work done by the management team and all the staff at the Art Museum. I also see the continued development of a national platform, both on the revenue side and on the programmatic side.
All right. That's Mark Feldman, the incoming co-chair of the Phoenix Art Museum Board of Trustees. He's the current treasurer of that group. Mark, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
The New York Times reports Immigration and Customs Enforcement will begin going after people who have been ordered deported starting on Sunday. President Trump had announced the so-called raids last month, but the Times reports they were delayed due to pushback from within the immigration agency. Now, about 2,000 people will be targeted in at least 10 cities nationwide. That could include people without documentation who happen to be at the locations that immigration agents will visit. Last year, ICE removed more than 250,000 illegal immigrants, the vast majority convicted of a crime or had pending criminal charges. The ICE Phoenix office removed almost 27,000 individuals last year. That's third most of any ICE field office. Joining us now to offer some insight on the detention and removal of undocumented immigrants is sociologist David Fitzgerald. He's co-director of the Center for Comparative Immigration Studies at the University of California, San Diego. David, good morning.
Good morning.
So 2,000 people, based on what the president had been talking about, that doesn't seem like such a huge number.
Right. Well, the president has talked about a lot of things in his tweets. He talked about deporting millions of people. Now the ICE is talking about deporting 2,000 people. And, you know, we'll have to wait and see what actually happens. The last time that the president tweeted about this, the raids ended up being postponed. So we don't know yet what's actually going to happen this weekend.
Is it interesting in any way the fact that the president has announced basically when these are going to happen? Like, you think of a raid, you think of middle of the night, people are unaware that it's coming.
Right. That's what's really unusual about the situation. The idea of ICE raids is nothing new. There were many ICE raids during the Obama administration and previous administrations, but I'm not aware of any other incident where the administration has announced in advance that they're going to conduct a big set of raids. And I think that's really revealing about the goals of this policy. If the administration were really going after the worst of the worst, they wouldn't be letting them know in advance. I think this suggests that this move is a publicity stunt by the administration to try to show its base that it's being as tough as possible on immigration. But even if it is a publicity stunt, the consequences can be very serious for the people involved.
You know, it harkens back a little bit to something that was happening here in Arizona, and maybe to an extent in California as well, maybe around a decade or so ago, when policymakers were trying to basically get undocumented immigrants to self-deport, try to make life as unpleasant as possible here and convince them that it was in their interest to leave. Does it seem like this is maybe a little bit of what's happening here?
Well, I think one of the effects of these kinds of policies is definitely to spread fear in immigrant communities, and not simply the people who are being targeted, but more generally among immigrants, including immigrants who are here legally and might even be naturalized U.S. citizens. There's not very much evidence that people actually self-deport. That's a phrase that's been kicked around a lot. It was something that Kris Kobach, the former Kansas Secretary of State, came up with. But there's not much evidence that that actually happens. What does happen is that people are afraid and they tend to withdraw from their daily activities. Sometimes, at least in the short run, they take their kids out of school because they're worried about raids that might affect them when they're going to pick up their kids. So it has a lot of collateral consequences.
Any sense of how what we might be seeing on Sunday differs from what ICE does on a daily basis?
Well, we know that about 4/5 of the immigrants that are arrested by ICE in the interior are coming through the Secure Communities program. So those are people who are already under custody in a state or county facility, and then they're turned over to ICE. So about 1/5 of those arrests are done in the community along the lines of these raids that we're going to see. So in some ways, that's business as usual for ICE. What's a little bit unusual here, and as a departure from what was happening at the end of the Obama administration, is that ICE has said very explicitly this week that if they encounter other people around who are not their original targets but who don't have papers, that those people will also be arrested. So that's a change from a policy at the end of the Obama administration, and it goes back to really the policy of the early Obama administration.
So potentially that number 2,000 could, I mean, that doesn't have to be the cap, right? I mean, if that might be what they're targeting, but if they find more people without documentation where they're going, that number 2,000 could go up.
That's right. That's right.
All right. That's David Fitzgerald, co-director of the Center for Comparative Immigration Studies at UC San Diego. David, thanks for the insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Lauren Gilger, along with Mark Brody. Still to come, stay tuned at 10 o'clock for The Takeaway. And we just heard Bruce tell us that the monsoon season is officially here. The storms may start rolling in soon. Mark, do you love these, or do they just drive you crazy?
One of my favorite things on earth is watching rain.
Yeah. Oh, see, this is perfect. Okay. So we learned that even though some people do hate them, we also learned last year that everyone has some kind of story about the monsoon. So we're bringing our series back, our Monsoon Stories series, back this summer, and we need your help as last time. So this time around, we are telling stories about how the monsoons tickle our five senses, how they look, feel, sound, smell, even taste. So if you want to join in and tell us those stories, you have two ways you can participate. You can call us. The number is 480-774-8299. You can leave us a voicemail. It might end up on air. Or send us a note to the show at kjzz.org and tell us about your monsoon stories. Or you can always send us your favorite monsoon photo you took, and they might end up showcased on our website.
Electric scooters will soon be available in downtown Phoenix. The city council has approved a 6-month pilot program for e-scooters. It's expected to start in mid-September. Companies taking part will be allowed up to 300 scooters each and will have to apply for city permits to take part, and riders will be limited to an area of downtown. At the end of the 6 months, the city's street transportation department will recommend to the council whether to try another pilot program, make the program permanent, or let it end. With me to talk more about this is Michael Cano, a traffic engineer for the city of Phoenix and lead for its e-scooter program. And Michael, are there companies so far that have expressed interest in renting scooters to Phoenix riders?
Yes, there's about 6 to 7 potential vendors that have been involved in our developing this process. They actually helped us assist with public outreach. We reached out to 10 neighborhood associations to just kind of get them to know that this pilot program is coming. We're developing rules and regulations. These are the ideas that we have, and it was their time to actually provide input.
Now, I know you've gotten input from a lot of different stakeholders, and I want to hear about what you heard from some of them. First off, I'm curious about people who live and work and sort of spend time in downtown. I would imagine that there's a good number of them who are really eager to have these kinds of devices around.
Yeah, so there's definitely part of the population that lives and work in the downtown area where the pilot program will be, and they were definitely for it. It's just another choice for transportation. Also, they might look at it as for tourists as well. So there's definitely a demand for micromobility, definitely a demand for multimodal transportation, and just the shared economy is something that's going to be here for a while.
From whom did you hear concerns? I mean, who was nervous about what this might be, and who was sort of really interested in, for example, not riding them on sidewalks or having a cap on them or having geographic limits or how fast they could go?
So we were lucky to have the voice of the neighborhood. And yes, we have some neighbors or residents that are definitely for it, and other neighbors that maybe just have certain concerns. So definitely riding on the sidewalk, we felt that prohibiting riding on the sidewalk would be best. So also visual blight as well. So that's some of the feedback that we got, that, you know, they didn't want just scooters just lying around, something that they were concerned about, and also safety. So how are we actually going to convey the safety message to the riders?
How does what Phoenix is doing relate to what some of your neighbors are doing in terms of other Valley cities and how they're handling, be it bike share, scooter share, whatever else the new technology might be coming forward?
Right. So the City of Phoenix is a member of the National Association of City Transportation Officials, NACTO, and they definitely have an influence on shared micromobility. But we also have our unique program that it might be different from, say, the city of Tempe or Scottsdale or maybe another major city. So one of the major differences is that it's going to be a permit process, and how we review their application might be different. The other big, I would say, unique requirement is parking. So we're going to have parking approved designations that we're going to actually designate parking locations within the boundary area, and they're going to be delineated, and the scooter companies need to deploy their scooters on these designated parking locations, and riders need to also end the ride and park at these designated locations. So it's basically kind of like a virtual hub.
Is it difficult, I guess, to get that word out to riders, for example, that, you know, if you're riding it to a restaurant, you can't just, for example, leave it outside when you walk in? And I'm wondering if the companies themselves bristled at all at some of the regulations that you're putting in place.
Well, I think this market is changing, it's evolving. So a year ago, they might have been really reluctant to have some like a kind of a dock or virtual dock system. But I think they've realized that they need to change with the demands of the city. And there is a way for the city to help with some of the concerns from the public, like visual blight, and also to help maintain the city streets and the public right-of-way.
So what will the city be looking at during that 6-month pilot program? And what kind of data will you be looking at? And what will you be trying to evaluate in terms of what the next step might be?
So we want to look at the demand to see the demand trends. Is it going to be just a novelty for the first 3 months and then taper off, or is it going to have a steady increase in demand or ridership? So we also want to know where most users are going to start and end their trip. So if it's pushing towards the northern limits or even it's spread out through the boundary area, then that's something that we could kind of plan for maybe different facilities, like bike facilities, or somehow we might need to change the parking locations. So that's something that we're looking forward to. So we want to see where people are going to go or want to go.
Are there metrics in place in terms of trying to figure out once the 6-month period is over that, yes, we should keep it going as it is. We should do a full-on let scooters in everywhere. We should maybe mildly expand the boundaries. We should just not have them at all.
We definitely, with looking at trends where the rides will end, that is just one metric. The other metric is incident compared to trips. We want to look at that. So we want to make that, compare that to, say, to other cities that are our size as well.
Incidents in terms of like safety, like
exactly.
Accidents, traffic accidents, that kind of thing?
Right. So some type of collision that it could be minor or any other like incident problems, you know, is it incidents with just the vehicle itself?
All right. Michael, thanks a lot for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Michael Cano is a traffic engineer for the City of Phoenix and the lead for the city's e-scooter program. This is the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
What's up? I'm Chris Trevine. I'm from Clementine, a band that I started with my best friend, Christian Rich. Right now, we're running a youth music workshop. Are you guys ready? Yeah! And we show the kids what it's like to be at one of our concerts, and then we invite the kids to come up to play guitar and play drums themselves. I want them to be able to feel like they can do it. So I hope that this like hands-on, getting to see behind the curtain, you know, they get to see what it's like to be grown up and to actually be pursuing your dreams. Like, how often do kids get to hit something like as hard as they want and make noise and be cheered for it?
That's local musician Chris Trevine teaching kids how to play the guitar and drums at a boys and girls club in Scottsdale. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we need a lot more tuning up, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Okay, Mark, so when you think of Paris, what comes to mind?
This will be a great shock to you. Baguettes.
Ah, well, I mean, and the perfect answer. Paris is, you know, it's iconic. And that also goes for the music, which many people might have answered for that question. But if I hear, like, romantic strains from an accordion or a violin with some French lyrics, I'm instantly transported to a cafe, sitting in Paris, sipping an espresso. It sounds great right now because it's super hot outside. And that is exactly what Julia Cantor and her group Paris Chanson do when they perform. Cantor is originally from Ukraine, and she studied and lived in Paris, where she says she fell in love with the language and the music. She launched the ensemble 5 years ago alongside her husband and a diverse group of musicians in L.A.
So my husband's also from Russia, and we have a Moroccan-Israeli singer and other musicians on bass and drums, piano and violin. And originally, we had just wanted to actually just kind of do an evening of French music, and it had such an impact. There were so many people from all over the world who came to that evening that we thought, oh, this is something interesting. Let's do this again. We did it again a few more times, and literally, people were being turned away, and we thought, we struck some kind of a cultural chord. And that was really the beginning of launching a full band and going out and starting to perform in various jazz clubs and eventually going on tour.
Let's also talk about the history here. There's a connection between French music and Eastern Europe, where you're originally from.
Yes, a really surprising, interesting connection. During the former Soviet Union, American and British music was banned. And so while the Beatles were forbidden, French music was welcomed. And so the French artists like Joe Dassin, were invited to perform there. And really, the French music became like the music of people's lives, really the soundtrack to their lives. So many Eastern Europeans, when they come to our shows, they don't speak French, but they know these songs. These were the songs that their parents sang to them. These were the songs from their first date. You know, it's very emotional for them.
So this is definitely like a nostalgic thing in that part of the world.
Absolutely. But one of our goals is to bring these songs back to people in a new and fresh way. So we always do original renditions mm-hmm. of the music that's familiar to them, and yet they're going to hear it hopefully in a way they've never heard it before through our ensemble.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds, when you listen to it, like there is a nostalgic aspect to this, but it definitely sounds like there's like a world music aspect. There's definitely some jazz notes in there. Tell us about the composition. Yes.
So we have violin, piano, upright bass, drums, and guitar. And one of our singers is a Moroccan Israeli, so he naturally brings that world music flavor. Mm. And the violin, of course, brings a lot of gypsy elements. And, of course, the Russian, we have the Russian elements as well, because we do French music with a Russian twist. Mm. So violin is really the instrument that kind of brings both the French and the Russian together with the gypsy sound.
Yeah, that's definitely where that comes out. It's so cool.
M'appelle l'Oriental, de bras hauts, regard fatal. Et l'on m'appelle l'Oriental, car moi je suis.
You mentioned falling in love with the French language as well as French music. How does it feel to you to sing in French? I spoke French. I always say I used to speak French when I lived there, and and I've lost it since. But it's such a sing-songy language to speak.
Yes, it's so romantic. It's such a, it's just a beautiful language, and it's an emotional language. And I always felt a deep connection to it. I'm fluent in French, but I always felt like I was French from a former life. And when I sing in French, I feel really deeply connected to my soul and to the audience. It's just a deep sense of connection.
Et si tu n'existais pas, dis-moi pourquoi j'existerais. Pour traîner dans un monde sans toi, sans espoir et sans regret. Et si tu n'existais pas, je serais demandé de l'amour. Comme un peintre qui voit sous ses doigts naître les couleurs du jour.
I think that most people associate French music and French culture with elegance, with romance, with poetry. It's just I think it evokes, it's evocative in that way.
Yeah.
And then there's all these cultures from all over the world who have these personal connections to the music, like Eastern Europeans and people from the Middle East and many other places.
What's the connection in the Middle East?
Our Moroccan-Israeli singer, he told me, Max Cohen, he told me that he was very surprised when they immigrated to Israel when he was 16 from Morocco, that many French songs by Aznavour, by Piaf, were translated into Hebrew and became staples of Israeli culture. So a lot of times we have many Israelis who come to our shows and they'll hear the songs and they'll say, oh, no, that's a Hebrew song. And we'll say, no, that's a very, very famous French song that just became such an important part of Israeli culture.
So going around the country and performing this music now, why do you think it is so universal? Why do you think it strikes a chord?
I think that it's just in general, it's music that is passionate, that's romantic, that's elegant, that's poetic. But wherever we go, these cultural groups who have this passionate connection to this music, they come to our shows. So as soon as we get booked in a new city, in Seattle, in Portland, where Phoenix, wherever we're going, I connect with the cultural groups, the cultural organizations, the Russians, Armenians, Romanians, Israelis, Lebanese, Moroccans. I reach out to those cultural groups in each city, and I let them know this show is coming to your city, and we'll be performing the music of Aznavour, Dessaint, Piaf, Adamo, Macias. When they hear those names, it's immediately, oh my gosh, this is the music of my soul, you know. Yeah. This is the soundtrack to my life. So that's how we initially make that connection with them.
Yeah. And what kinds of reactions do you get from those groups when they get to see it performed live like this?
Oh, it's incredibly emotional. People are singing along, they're swaying, they're dancing, sometimes they're even crying. There's such a profound sense of joy and connection.
И на все деньги купи целое море цветов.
Julia Cantor, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Из окна, из окна, из окна видишь ты, кто влюблен, кто влюблен, кто влюблен и всерьез. Свою жизнь для тебя превратит цветы.
Perry Chansons will be performing at the Musical Instrument Museum this Saturday and Sunday.
Может, сошла ты с ума, как продолжение сна, площадь цветами полна, похолодеет душа.